In Finland, the static noise of a dial-up modem and the stress of a slow web connection soon will be relics of the past. Beginning next July, every person in the country of Finland will have the legal right to a 1 megabyte internet connection. It's the first country in the world to make broadband internet access a legal requirement. Suvi Linden is Finland's Minister of Communications, and she's on the phone from Finland. First of all, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Why does your government consider broadband internet access to be a legal right?
We are pushing forward very strongly the development of information society. We decided that broadband connections are no longer this kind of luxury products and just for entertainment. But I think in a short time, there will be more and more e-services like net banking and stuff like that for citizens to use, and therefore we really need to have access and possibility to use e-services.
Will citizens have to pay money out of their own pockets?
Yeah, they pay for the monthly payment for the connection.
What happens if a citizen can't afford this?
At this moment, the broadband connection, the prices are fairly low. Still, this is an option. It's not compulsory for anyone to have a connection.
There's a little over 5 million people in the country, and the new law requires telecom companies to start providing this high-speed internet services across the country. How has the private sector in Finland responded to this new law?
It's a common project because teleoperators know that since we get the better infrastructure, it's a good possibility for them also provide new e-services. And I think that in the long term, they will profit on this decision, even though, of course, they weren't very happy about it. But we have also a goal for 2015. We want to provide 100 megabyte. But we start with 1 megabyte, and by the end of 2010, 99% of the population is covered by wireless connection.
Suvi Linden is the Minister of Communications in Finland, and she joined us by phone. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
In early December, delegates from around the world will sit down to talk climate change at a major UN-sponsored conference in Copenhagen. There will, no doubt, be political wrangling over how to reduce carbon emissions, but away from the politics is the work of climatologists, the people who come up with the models that predict how climate change will unfold. Dennis Wheeler from the University of Sunderland in Britain is one of those climatologists, but he's not only looking at the latest cutting-edge data to map the future of weather. He's reaching back hundreds of years to the logbooks kept by sailors during those early, harrowing naval voyages in the Age of Discovery.
Meteorological journal and sea log of His Majesty's ship, Isabella. Wind direction south, wind force, light airs, temperature 53 degrees. Barometric pressure, 29.
Dennis Wheeler joins us from the University of Sunderland. Welcome to the program.
Hello, Guy.
Tell me about these logbooks. Where do they come from and what were they used for?
Well, the vast majority of logbooks we use are the logbooks of ships in the service of the Royal Navy. The Admiralty made it compulsory for all captains, masters and lieutenants, that's to say senior officers on board, to maintain a regular daily logbook of their activities in which they had to describe what was going on board, supplies of food, water taken in, and so on and so forth. But they also were very careful to stipulate that officers had to record the weather.
So they're basically recording temperature and wind speed and barometer pressure and things like that every day.
Well, first of all, from 1680 until about, let's say, 1770, 1780, the first 100 years, we don't have any instruments on board. They were far too valuable and far too complex to put on board something as uncertain as a ship. And for the first 100 years, what we have is useful information on wind force, wind direction, and the general state of the weather. Now, just because it doesn't have numbers doesn't mean it isn't useful for us. In fact, it's extremely useful information. Mm-hmm. But we find that it's very valuably supplemented from about 1780 onwards by the increasing appearance of barometers, that's for measuring air pressure, and thermometers for measuring air and sometimes sea temperatures, which are regularly carried on board by officers of the Royal Navy and by some other ships as well.
And some of these logbooks are from relatively famous journeys. The HMS Beagle, the ship on which Darwin traveled, Captain Cook's boat, the Resolution.
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I mean, this particular project that we've just completed is one that is focused specifically on the logbooks of voyages of discovery. You've mentioned Darwin already, and he was on board the Beagle for its 3 or 4 year circumnavigation of the globe. And we have Cook as well. These are all skilled scientists, and it's supplemented the normal daily observational routine with much more detailed observations, sometimes taking thermometer readings every hour. And these are amazingly useful for us.
Professor Wheeler, what questions do you hope to answer by looking at this data?
What we need to do is to get a very firm understanding of the degree of natural variation, not only over land, and we understand that fairly clearly now, but we do need to look at the oceans as well. They're so big and they're such an important part of the whole climatic system. And once we've got that clearer picture, what it means is that the people who are engaged in predictions for the future can take their models, the general circulation models, as they know, in the GCMs. These models need to be calibrated, and we can only calibrate them against past conditions. Well, fairly obviously, the more data we have for the past, the more accurate our picture of the past, the better is the calibration on those models. So when you use them to look to the future, we can be just that bit more precise about how temperatures are likely to change over the next 20, 50, or maybe even 100 years.
From these logbooks, are we able to get a sense of how far the polar ice caps have receded and whether there was, you know, more sea ice at the time these journeys were taking place, you know, versus 50 years later or 100 years later or today?
That's right. It's a very good question. The answer is yes, we can. And this is where the non-instrumental data that I mentioned before is so useful, because these ships were careful to record their encounters with icebergs, pack ice and ice that would freeze them up for the winter, because many of them in the Arctic Oceans would be quite prepared to spend a winter up there and engaged usually in a search for the Northwest Passage, the quick route through to the North Pacific Ocean. So we are able to plot very carefully year by year where the ice advanced and how far it retreated. So the summer retreats, the winter advances are dated and spatially defined for us, and that's extremely useful data.
Now, the idea is that these logbooks will all be digitized eventually, which will give everybody access to see them. What's it like to handle those old logbooks?
It's absolutely fascinating. I mean, some of the older ones that we use from the less famous voyages, we're aware that when we open those pages, it's probably the first time they've been opened in the 200 years since they were written. Mm-hmm. And that's an absolutely extraordinary and very enriching experience.
Dennis Wheeler is a climate researcher at the University of Sunderland in Britain. Dennis Wheeler, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
For more on the latest tech news, I'm joined, as we are most Mondays, by Omar Gayaga. He covers technology culture for the Austin American Statesman. Welcome back, Omar.
Hi, Michelle. Good to talk to you.
Well, it sounds like we have a grab bag of news today, and we start with Microsoft. I guess this has been a big week for Microsoft. Tell us why.
Yeah, they are launching Windows 7 on Thursday. This is the most recent version of the venerable Windows operating system, and kind of a do-over for them. They did not get a lot of love in early 2007 when they launched Windows Vista, which, you know, since then has taken shots from all sides for its interface, for being a little bit intrusive when it comes to security features. So this new version, Windows 7, which ranges in several versions that start at $119 all the way up to $299, it's sleeker. And for people that sort of held off, that stuck with Windows XP like I did, it's definitely worth the upgrade, in my opinion, although it's going to be a lot of trouble for people with older hardware who never made the jump to Vista.
Microsoft has had a lot of trouble with security issues. Did they solve that problem?
Well, it's a new operating system. It's going to have security holes. They've been issuing a lot of patches. Last Tuesday, they issued a giant security patch. They're going to be plugging away at that for some time. But a lot of the other features that I've been impressed with Windows 7, just its speed, how stable it is. I haven't had a single crash with it since I've been using it for the last 3 or 4 weeks. And they are going to be doing, you know, pretty big publicity blitz. They've got an episode of Family Guy coming up that will feature Windows 7. They are opening the first of many Windows retail stores. The first one will be in Scottsdale, Arizona. So for Microsoft, yeah, it's a very big week. They've got a lot riding on this. And this time out, they've got a much better product to sell than they did with Windows Vista, it seems.
Now, another Microsoft-related item I want to ask you about. Researchers for the company developed a camera to help people with Alzheimer's and dementia, but I understand the camera is going to be sold to the average consumer sometime next year, moving, I guess, beyond the R&D phase to the consumer phase. Tell me about that.
Right. They have a product called SenseCam that was actually developed in the UK by Microsoft's research arm in Cambridge. And it is a camera that's worn around the neck with a lanyard. Now, when it senses movement, it takes a photo, and the memory that it has on board can store many thousands of low-resolution photographs. And where Alzheimer's comes in is that people suffering with Alzheimer's could carry this around with them, and it would be able to track their movement and show where they've been and who they've been in contact with.
Sounds a little bit like Big Brother, though, doesn't it?
Well, it's you know, you can always take it off. It's just something that kind of you carry around your neck. And but for people obviously who are bloggers who want to document their everyday movement, you know, doing life casting or life blogging as they call it, this would definitely be a useful tool.
Cell phone companies are starting to push eco-friendly products for their Prius-driving NPR listening clientele, I understand. Which companies are going green?
You know, this came to our attention last week. I got some information from Sprint about something they're doing with the Audubon Society to introduce bird call tweets for your cell phone as ringtones. We could hear the Baltimore Oriole or the Carolina Wren. As we kind of started looking into that, we also found other ways that that wireless companies are getting into the eco-friendly market. Sprint introduced a phone that is actually made of corn called the Reclaim. It's actually made from a corn-based bioplastic, and 80% of its parts are recyclable. And not to be outdone, T-Mobile has a cell phone called the Renew, whose plastic is made from recyclable water bottles.
Omar, let's go abroad if we can. There's tech news, I understand, out of Finland.
Right. In Finland, a law was recently passed making broadband internet access a legal right for all citizens. This would go into effect next July, and it would guarantee that every person in Finland, which has a population of about 5.3 million, would be guaranteed 1 megabit per second broadband speeds.
So wait a minute. The right to life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness, and broadband access.
Yes, the right to internet access. And this is actually just a first step for that country. They actually want to get it up to 100 megabits per second, which is very fast internet access, much faster than most people have here, by the end of 2015.
Well, Omar, always good to talk to you. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much. And we'll have links to all of these on the All Tech Considered blog at npr.org/alltech, including something called Sockscriptions, subscriptions for socks on the web, just to kind of whet your appetite there. We'll have a separate blog entry for that.
Omar Gayaga covers technology culture for the Austin American Statesman. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Now to another type of cyber socializing, online dating. Love may be blind, but in the virtual world, it is not colorblind. According to new data compiled by the free online dating service OkCupid, racial biases are very much part of the romantic choices we are making online, even when we insist that they are not. The site looked at the messaging behaviors of over a million users and found that black women were the most slighted and white men and women were the most favored when it comes to seeking out a partner in cyberspace. To talk more about this, we invited OkCupid co-founder and CEO Sam Yagan. Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you set up an algorithm to determine who was writing who back. Why did you want to know?
Well, we were intrigued by the fact that we had so much actual behavior among people on our dating site, OkCupid. There are so many surveys and so many people who have theories about, you know, what role race plays, but we all know that people respond differently when they're responding to a survey versus actually the behavior they exhibit in real life. So we realized that we had millions of interactions between people of all races and that we could begin to look at what factor race played in those interactions.
And what made it particularly interesting is that you ask people what they were looking for and then you could determine whether their behavior matched what it is they said, which is one of the things that intrigued me. And I have to tell you, some of the findings will be fairly painful, depending on your values, for some people to to discover, you found that Black women get the least response to their messages. They also respond the most to received messages. You found that Indian men fare very poorly overall, but also with Indian women, that Indian women do well overall. White women and men do the best. Now, I think one question people will have is, does this reflect who's in the pool? For example, is it possible that white men and women do the best because there are just more of them in the pool?
Sure, that's a great question. And what we've observed so many people, over a million people on our site, and it turns out that the percentage of each ethnic group that we have matches fairly closely to that in the population. So we don't think that there is a skew based on the actual percentages in the population.
So what do you think is going on here?
Well, because we're able to adjust for compatibility, and what that means is we've already normalized for how well we think each person is going to get along with the other person, the only factor left in determining response rate really is the aesthetic appearance of the person who sent you that message. Obviously, there's more to aesthetic appearance than just race, but that is going to be the first thing that someone notices when they look at a picture. So we think that there really is racial bias in determining who people want to date.
You know, it's no secret that race is a factor in dating, you know, offline. For example, there's a big story right now making the rounds, particularly in cable, about a justice of the peace in Louisiana who refused to sign a marriage certificate for a biracial couple, saying he feared for their children. So it's no secret that people think this way. But why did you think, or did you think, that it would be different online? And I do want to emphasize again that you're matching people's behavior against their reported preferences. So there is a variance there. But why did you think it would be different online?
Perhaps we were too hopeful. We certainly hoped to find data that was going to show that we were, that the people were actually acting on their stated preferences and that their behaviors were similar to what they were stating. But one good example, we ask a question, is interracial marriage a bad idea? And across the board, among whites, for example, 93% say no, 7% say yes. But then when actually asked, would you strongly prefer to date someone of your own skin color, white women, 54% said yes, they strongly prefer, whereas across the board, every other ethnic group said no, that was not a priority for them.
So what response are you getting to this survey? As I said, this is, some people will say, yeah, so what? But other people will say, ow. Ouch, this is kind of painful stuff. What are people saying?
I think people first tried to poke holes in the methodology of what we're observing, and then first knee-jerk reactions on our blog were largely around, well, here's why your conclusions aren't valid. But I think, as there's been more thoughtful debate about it, maybe it's not that surprising after all that certain ethnic groups or racial groups are going to be treated differently, and that the way we act is not necessarily reflective of what we say.
Sam Yagan is the co-founder and CEO of OkCupid. It's a free online dating site. He joined us from Chicago. And if you want to know more about the study we're talking about, we'll have a link on our site. Just go to npr.org, go to programs, and click on Tell Me More. Sam, thank you.
Thank you so much.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, social media refuseniks, young people who are just saying no to Facebook and Twitter. It's just one of the conversations we're having this morning about how we are living online or not. And we'll talk about the role race plays in cyber dating. You think race doesn't matter? Think again. That's a little later. But first, are we spending too much time on Twitter to the exclusion of more productive activities? No, I have not been talking to your boss or put some screening device on your computer. Last week, Evgeny Morozov wrote an eye-catching article for Foreign Policy Magazine's website. It was titled Anne Frank plus Balloon Boy equals Slacktivism. Mr. Morozov is a fellow at Georgetown University's Institute for the Study of Diplomacy. He's at work on a book about the impact of the internet on global politics, and he joins us now from our studio in Washington, D.C. Welcome. Thank you.
Hi, Michelle. Good to be here.
So let's jump right in. You're right. The amount of energy that had been exerted by the Twitterati to save the now infamous Balloon Boy would probably be enough to prevent at least a few dozen African genocides. How you figure that?
Well, I mean, if you look at the most popular topics discussed on Twitter at the end of last week, they actually, you know, the balloon boy dominated pretty much everything. You know, it dominated politics, it dominated healthcare, it dominated everything else. More than that, you actually had a particular campaign before, you know, it turned out that the boy was actually hiding and was not, you know, in the balloon. There was actually a campaign on Twitter to try to save him, to try to influence events, right? To try to maybe contact, you know, 911 or to try to contact, you know, the sheriff's office and
do something.
Or to
encourage the authorities to make the maximum effort to help this child.
And the ease with which now it is possible to form these issue groups, you know, it's of course could be extremely good and productive, as we've seen with events in Iran, for example, you know, earlier this year. But sometimes I think these people go a little bit too far and they start campaigning on issues before actually thinking them through and verifying that the problem actually exists. And I think that this creates this almost on-demand activism where, you know, whatever you feel bad about the world, you can actually get involved for 30 seconds, join a Facebook group or sign an online petition.
But what's so terrible? What's so terrible about getting involved for 30 mm-hmm. seconds if perhaps 30 seconds is enough to achieve an outcome?
Yes. Well, the question is, does it actually achieve an outcome? And my understanding has been that in many cases, it's all just about making you feel good. You know, this notion of slacktivism, you know, you are still a slacker without actually getting involved, you know, deep, but you also kind of, you know, visibly you are doing something. All your friends see that you are involved, but your involvement is for those purposes only. It's only to impress your friends, to impress your Facebook community, to impress your Twitter followers, while the actual impact is very minimal.
So it's what some might call cheap grace. But if you take it to the conclusion of your piece, which I understand was somewhat mm-hmm. tongue-in-cheek, mm-hmm. what isn't preventing an African genocide a little different than calling sure. on the sheriff's department or calling on even the National Guard to get involved mm-hmm. in a particular incident? Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It seems to me that I understand your argument
sure.
about how this is
sure.
this is sort of diffusing energy that
yes.
could be otherwise and more productively
mm-hmm.
directed.
Mm-hmm.
But what else should people do? Should they just wait? Stop? What should they do?
Well, I think people who organize these campaigns should just be smarter when they set them up. And they should be more knowledgeable in terms of directing people's energy and, you know, setting up concrete targets and saying that, you know, we want to achieve this and you have to stay involved after you have joined, you know, the Facebook group. My favorite example is this campaign to feed the children of Africa on Facebook. Right? You look at it, it has 1.2 million members. And then you actually look at what these members have done. It's just raising $6,000. Which is, you know, less than half a cent per person. And then, of course, having this mass of people, you could probably involve them in much better and more productive ways. So I guess my criticism is not so much to people who get involved, but to people who lead these campaigns who are not very strategic about setting up goals and actually following up with people who join them.
But by definition, these are, how can I say, leaderless? It's mm-hmm. almost like you're mm-hmm. a leader because you say you are.
Mm-hmm.
What are you saying? Are you saying that people, if they're going to put themselves out there, they mm-hmm. should take the time to educate themselves or to put in some front-end time to decide if they're really doing the right thing? They obviously think they are doing the right thing.
Of course. I mean, that definitely wouldn't hurt. I mean, I think educating yourself about the cause before you take it on is a good piece of advice for any campaigner. Right, because what we do see happen in many cases is that people join non-existent causes. There was this very interesting campaign in Europe, in Denmark, earlier this year, where 28,000 people signed up to save a fountain in Denmark who nobody was threatening. So it was just a hoax. Someone set up this, you know, imaginary cause, and 28,000 people went for it. Right, and again, it proves that we have to be a little bit more careful when we are choosing which campaigns to join.
We'll look forward to your book.
Well, thank you.
Evgeny Murasov is Yahoo Fellow at Georgetown University's Institute for the Study of Diplomacy. As we mentioned, he's working on a book about the impact of the internet on global politics, and he joined us here in our Washington, D.C. studio. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Let's say you haven't heard Evgeny's complaints. You've checked your Facebook feed several times today or tweeted your latest random thoughts. If so, you're not alone. And if you're under 40, most of your peers with computer access are probably already signed up and reveling in the wonders of social media. Not having a Facebook page has become, well, not cool. Not quite normal, like not having a cell phone. But not everybody is so eager to be so connected. Washington Post reporter Ian Shapiro recently wrote about social networking refuseniks. He joins us now in our Washington studio, along with Natasha Hawkins, one of the abstainers featured in the article. Welcome to both of you. Thank you for coming.
Hello.
Thanks for having us.
Ian, what made you think about this?
I think it was a combination of my own reporting. Facebook has become so valuable when I look for people. And I used to joke with colleagues in the newsroom that if I couldn't find somebody on Facebook who is part of my beat, the millennial generation, a red flag was raised. In the spirit of what Google might say, there's a lack of transparency or even a lack of credibility.
Something's wrong.
We were joking about that. I don't think Natasha has a lack of credibility. But you get the point.
We're relieved, though. So you thought, okay, well, what about these people? And you point out in your piece that the vast majority of people in the millennial generation are social networking aficionados. About 85% of all internet users 18 to 34 visited Facebook, MySpace, or Twitter in August, according to ComScore. It's a Reston-based internet data research company. You said about 84% of 18 to 29-year-olds check social networking sites at least once a week, according to a study from the Pew Research Center for the People and the Press. So what did you find out about the people who are not feeling it?
I found out that people don't use social networking sites for a lot of reasons. Privacy reasons, they feel like they want to connect with people on a more emotional level, human-to-human level. And I think there is merit and value to that.
And you're not saying that just because Natasha's sitting right here.
I am saying that because Natasha's right here.
Okay. Natasha, what about you? You belong to a dance company in D.C. You're 28. It would seem like you'd have lots of reasons to participate in these sites. You'd want to let people know about your upcoming performances or things of that sort. So why are you not interested?
I know I'm not interested. I mean, I have a 9-to-5 during the day. I'm on the computer the entire time, and I just don't have the energy or the additional time to log on to the computer, log into my cell phone. It's a little bit of overkill. Everyone else in my company is on Facebook or Twitter or MySpace. So if something needs to get posted, that's what they're there for. I just run the company. I'm the smoke and mirrors type. But no, I'm joking.
You just don't have time. It's like another layer of
one more password to remember outside of work. I don't want to.
Do your friends make fun of you because of
all
this?
All the time.
You are so...
All the time. They're like, Tasha, what's wrong with you? I'm like, there's nothing wrong with me. It's just not important for me right now.
Why do they want you to be on it?
They want me to see, you know, the pictures. They just want me to be a part. And I'm not the one that feels that has to be a part of something. I know how to reach my friends.
Okay. And so, Ian, do you think that there might be a counter trend emerging where it's more cool to be off the grid?
I think that has been talked about in the media. I think that most notably Virginia Heffernan of the New York Times Magazine had recently written about this, that she noticed in her circle of friends that this was dropping off. That being said, I don't think that's the case. Facebook just announced its 300 million user worldwide. It's becoming more valuable in society. You know, social networking sites are being used to combat genocide. They're being used to spread the word about important information. Social networking sites like Twitter and Facebook are actually essential now in the protests in Tehran, for instance. I mean, we had a State Department official called up Twitter to say, please don't go through your scheduled maintenance because this is a way for folks in Tehran to express themselves during the protests. So social networking, I think, is here to stay.
One of the things I am curious about, and Natasha, this totally resonates with me, is the time factor. I wonder, what is it that people are not doing while they're maintaining these social media sites? Because I have to tell you, I wouldn't be doing it if I didn't have people to help me do it. Because my attitude is, I have to get to the grocery store. So do you have any sense of what it is that people are not doing while they're doing this?
They're not spending time with their spouses. They are not spending time with their children. It was interesting. We had in the Saturday section, we have a free-for-all section. And one of the – normally these letters are very angry letters about the Washington Post and how we're covering things. But there was one letter that stuck out to me because it was positive, and it said, I was reading the paper online for free and I started subscribing in the print edition. And he says, I am now spending more time with my wife and my children. And he wrote this really poetic thing that almost made me cry about basically in general, the less time we spend with the computer screen, maybe the more time we interact with human beings. And I think that gets back to what Natasha was saying, that you do spend more time with people. I know I, for instance, probably spend a little more time on the computer and Facebook and Twitter, and I probably should be talking to my wife.
Okay.
Sorry about that, Caroline.
Okay. Well, at least you know we're thinking about you.
Yeah.
Natasha, final thought. Is there anything that might tempt you back on? I know you did belong to one site briefly, Black Planet, but you left. Anything might tempt you back on?
I don't think there's going to be much unless there's an additional 5 hours added to my day, which will probably be filled up with other stuff like grocery shopping, cleaning my house, taking care of bills and business. Other than that, I don't think anything is going to tempt me unless it gets to a point where my career changes, where it's necessary for me to be on. I just want to preface in saying that I think these social networking sites are valuable in certain careers and certain situations. Just for my own personal feed, I just don't have the time.
You are not feeling it. That's okay. Washington Post reporter Ian Shapiro recently wrote about what he's calling social networking refuseniks. One of those refuseniks is D.C. resident Natasha Hawkins, who joined us here in our Washington, D.C. studio as well. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
If you want to read the piece we're talking about, we'll have a link on our website. Just go to npr.org and click on Tell Me More. And of course, I've taken the plunge. You can find me on Facebook. I'll be your friend.